Welcome back to True Crime Broads. We have a very exciting guest today. We know you're all going to love this episode. We have true crime writer, bestseller, and TV personality, Aphrodite Jones, joining us. Aphrodite, thank you so much for coming on our show.
Thank you, ladies. I appreciate it.
We are so excited to have you on. We know that you have a brand new book out, and we want to hear about that. And also just kind of tell us how you got into true crime writing. We love your books. You're an amazing writer. I love the way you write very much like you're just talking to the person. Your style speaks to me exactly. You don't try to, sound all fancy. I get really bored when I read books like that. You sound like you're talking to me, and I love that.
Thank you. It's interesting. The way I got into this is by accident. I was living in Appalachia in eastern Kentucky, which is at the end of the planet, basically. There's no airport from 2.5 hours away. And I was a teacher there as a professor at a small college called Pikeville College. And I was also broadcasting on radio at the time, I was a news director. And so as I was broadcasting the news locally, an FBI agent killed his informant slash lover, Susan Daniel Smith,
Wow.
and was eventually convicted. He copped a manslaughter plea. He led the authorities to her bones. It took years before they figured it out. And I was so outraged that a hillbilly, as they called, or what I call mountain woman, had been ignored and had not been. The family had not been taken seriously because, after all, this is an FBI agent. Now,
Right.
ultimately, as I reported on the news, the FBI agent has never, that person is the only person that has ever been convicted of a homicide before or since. And I'm wondering to myself at the time, where in the heck is the news? Like, okay, I'm doing it locally here, but where's CNN? Where's anybody? And it just wasn't reported on those channels at that time. I don't know what was going on. It just wasn't. And I really was up in arms about it. So I had an agent for a book, another book I had written, and I pitched this, and he said, "Well, you got to write a true crime book." I said, "What's that? I mean, I don't write true crime." And he said, "Well, give it a shot." So I read In Cold Blood, and Truman Capote, you can't touch that as far as the best writer in the genre, I would say. But I realized, oh, I can do this. And sometimes it's better you don't know what you don't know.
Right.
And and so at the time, there were no FBI records, there were no state police that were cooperating with me. I had none of the things that I would typically have in any other book since. But I did have, and there was no trial. There were no witnesses that testified, nothing. And it was a plea deal. So I was interviewing the family of Susan Daniel Smith, and I did eventually get to interview some of the police and someone at the FBI, a couple of people, and I wrote that book. It became a bestseller, and it also transferred into a movie called Betrayed by Love for ABC, and Patricia Arquette played the lead. The movie ran for years. And my second book, Cruel Sacrifice, became a New York Times bestseller, hit the top of the charts and was there for months. So once that happened, a horrifying crime of four teenage girls who killed a 12-year-old girl and a lesbian love triangle craziness. Anyway, that book solidified my position in true crime. And even though it almost killed me to write that book because it was so horrifying and unspeakable, I was stuck with true crime. I was basically stuck with it. I was trying not to do
Awesome.
any more,
Well, that's good for us. Yeah, that's amazing.
it's
And
very difficult to be in this field in the way that I'm in this field for over 25 years now, where you really take in the subject matter and especially the victims and even the killers. And for a book, the way I write, I'm engrossed in the story. I go to the location where this happened. I live there. I live through the trial. I live through all of that. And I take it to heart. It's very difficult to continue to do this for so many years and not have it affect you. So you know, as I say, it's not something I chose. However, my third book, All She Wanted, which I later changed to All He Wanted, was the first transgender murder known of, publicized in any way in America. At that time, the word transgender wasn't even in our vocabulary here in this country at all. Happened in 1992. I wrote the book in 1993 and changed it to All He Wanted because once I, you know, all these years later, I realized this was never a she, he. This was a he who was always a he who had not had any hormones or any therapy or any surgery yet and was killed by two men who de-pantsed her, him, and she, as a woman again, went to the authorities and reported it, reported the rape. They raped her. And so she was a girl with her mom in Lincoln and sister, and then she became he when he left the house or left the town. And anyway, so it was a complicated story and one that really eventually became the movie Boys Don't Cry with Hilary Swank. So if you, if anyone's ever seen it, you would know the essence of the story. And so I kind of just became involved in controversial crimes, controversial stories, and that is my fate. And so I've decided to just, you know, many years ago to just accept it.
Yeah, I remember Hilary Swank knocked it out of the park acting her role as Brandon Tina. That was pretty amazing. I remember seeing it at the time. So, and we also know that you have done tons of work as an investigative reporter. Obviously you had lots of practice from investigating for your books and the in-depth. That's what I just love about too, about your shows. You obviously go really in-depth in your books, you know, you live and breathe it, but I also, you know, on the ID channel, your show, True Crime with Aphrodite Jones, those are riveting because they just go so much deeper. Renee and I were talking earlier how it's not very satisfying when you tune in to hear about a case and they skim the surface and it's stuff you've already heard. Yours is phenomenal. You've got experts on there. You're digging way deeper than anyone else digs. And I, as a refresher, I've already seen all these, but last night I watched a couple of them. I watched Anna Nicole Smith and I watched JonBenet Ramsey, and boy, those were
Michael Peterson.
Those
were, I watched.
That's when you watched. Yeah, yeah. We were just kind of going back over them because we knew you're coming on, and those are just so in depth and so impressive. Would you consider doing another TV show like that again?
Yes, and I'd like to do exactly the same show. What happened in that show is that I initially sold it as an author who does go in depth and who can tell the story in a different way, you know, engrossing the audience much more than, as you say, the surface. And that's how the first season went and the second. However, when NBC Peacock got a hold of the series and produced the next four seasons, over the course of that time, they kind of forgot that that was the message that was supposed to be what we're doing. Mm-hmm. And so it became different than what I had pitched or imagined. And so having said that, I want to go back to where I started and tell these stories, crime, true crime sagas, in a way that really captures the underneath the surface, the story that you didn't know about the story. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I'm headed to pitch. And we'll see what happens.
That's fantastic news. I'm glad to hear that. I hope that happens quickly.
Yeah,
can't wait to watch new ones. Yeah, that show is amazing. And anyone out there, a lot of us true crime, you know, followers have the ID Go app on the phone, and I watched those shows. I'd seen them on TV years and years ago, but to watch them on my phone on the ID Go app was kind of interesting.
Yeah,
it's just kind of handy. You're laying cool. there, you can pull it up on your phone. You gotta love technology, but because that wouldn't have been available probably when those shows came out. It's only been like, what, 12? I think it's like 2011, the ones that I watched. So it's not terribly long ago, but
Terribly. But you know, the interesting thing is my first season, which ran in 2010, is the season where I covered the biggest crimes, O.J. Simpson, Phil Spector, Chandra Levy, and and the Zodiac. And I covered stories that I did in my books about Michael Jackson, the book I wrote, Michael Jackson Conspiracy, and the book Red Zone, which was about the San Francisco dog mauling and the Aryan Brotherhood. Very heavy duty story. Michael Peterson, I did in that, all of those in the first season. And for some reason, that first season is not available to see on IndieGo. I don't know why. And yet I feel like that was one of my best seasons, frankly, because again, it was close to what I had pitched.
Right.
And I got information in those stories that no one's ever seen. Footage of OJ, where he's egging on, pretending he's got paparazzi at his house, but really it's his manager who's filming him. I got that footage. I got footage of Phil Spector, right? No one knows that. I got information from his manager, we're still close to this day, who told me exactly what was going on behind the scenes after OJ, you know, did it, claiming he didn't do it. And he told his manager that he did it, but he just didn't remember it. You know, so there were a lot of things that were in those shows. Again, Phil Spector, footage of him in his mansion, his weird castle in Alhambra, wearing puka beads and a Hawaiian shirt, talking about, you know, basically he's the king of the world and, you know, who are all these women? A very strange footage. And also interviews with his two adopted sons, who basically were like his little slaves in that castle. Just these are the kind of things that I am able to be drawn to and get. And, you know, it's the kind of thing I want to bring back again to audiences.
How did you get into Phil Spector's house/castle? How did you get in there?
Didn't get in the castle. I got into, I could have, but the wife at the time was asking for $25,000 to do so. So no, we didn't get into the castle. No, no, no. I got in because I got to his secretary/assistant and I interviewed her. Okay. And she's the one who spent all the time with Phil Spector and had taken that video, just like OJ Simpson's manager had taken that video. So I got it through her. And got to see the whole inside of the castle, and we aired that. So again, I wish those episodes were available. I can't put them on the air myself because they're owned by IDEA, have copies of the original versions, but one way or another.
Well, Phil Spector was so crazy. I remember hearing stories when he would record with bands, he would have like a pistol up on the counter. It basically just like, you know, this is here to intimidate people. And he wouldn't let people leave. I remember reading stuff like that about his recording sessions. It's pretty weird.
And it's very weird. I think he shot the ceiling when he was recording with one of the Beatles. And, you know, just crazy stuff. The man, I went to the trial. You know, most of these things, I go to the trial. I don't just, you know, skip out. I'm there for the entirety of it. I went to the trial and he would come in with his shoes that had lifts in them because he's very short, various wigs, different days, different wigs. And you didn't get unmasking until he was found guilty. But listening to the women who had been threatened, who were scared to death, who were trying to escape his castle or his presence all throughout the years prior to what happened to Lana, was the thing that really got to me, you know, would get to anybody, because those women had not been heard from in the first trial. This is the second retrial. And so again, you know, these are the things that matter to me. It matters to me, for example, that I was at the Bill Cosby trial, that I heard from those women who at a much younger age had been drugged and raped or somehow sexually violated, which they didn't remember because they woke up drugged somewhere else on the property, wherever it happened to be. And one young woman, I'll never forget it, turned and said to, now they were older, so many years later, and said, "You remember, don't you, Mr. Cosby?" And they cut it out. You know, the jury needs to, you know, offense, objective is, you know, that's can't be in, you know, but of course you can't unhear it. The jury heard it.
Right.
You know, he did that. But hearing from the women, again, the bigger story to me is all the people who were the victims prior to the murder of someone, because you know, it wasn't just Lana Clarkson who was, you know, the victim of this person, monster, although she was the end result. Had we known anything from these other women years prior,
yes,
she would perhaps be alive, you know, so there's all of those things.
Right. Yeah, he just seemed to, it's just so unfortunate for her, I guess, when she tried to get away from him, he took that rejection obviously very poorly and took care of business. And I don't know why he thought that he could get away with that. You shoot someone.
Well, he did. Remember, he got away with it. He had a first trial where it was, it was, I believe, a hung jury. In any case, they were able to retry him. They didn't acquit him, obviously, the first time, or they wouldn't retry him. But it was the second trial that I went to where you really had the ammunition that went after him. And I'll never forget the blood, the blood stain forensics on the thing, and how one expert testified blood doesn't go around a corner because it was blood found, microscopic blood found on the stairwell. And she shot herself, he claimed, in a chair in the main room. So how did this blood get around the corner? You know, things like that, which... You know, very unfortunate for the killers, but then again, that's how karma works, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I remember he died in prison several years back. And
thank goodness.
Yes.
Monster.
What a monster. And it just makes you wonder, how did he get to be that way? How did that happen? But I wonder that about all these cases.
Right.
So let's talk about your brand new book. We have had the pleasure of looking at it and reading it. And so Levi's Eyes, your brand new book. It's been out a few months now. Can you tell us a little bit about it and how you got drawn to it? I believe you did a show on it before you wrote the book, correct?
I did. So I filmed an episode on Levi's murder by his father, Carl Carlson, back in 10 years ago, 2014. And at that time, there was a murder of his first wife suspected. She burned in a fire in California, and that had never been designated a murder at that time. But it was the back of my mind because I knew, you know, this didn't just happen that he killed his 23-year-old son for insurance. There has to be more. And when I found out that, you know, his first wife died in a burning house in California, interesting thing about it was he saved his children out of that fire. So Levi was one of the children he saved. So he gets to New York and starts a whole new life with a second wife, Cindy Bess, who's her maiden name. And they have a child together. And Cindy's raising four children, his three children from his first marriage and their child together. And she believes he's a hero. You know, he went into a burning house and he would do things like say, I'm not a hero. You know, he'd downplay it so that he could, you know, have all the more believability, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until 2014 or 2013 where he was found guilty. And then when I went in 2014 to do that show, that I knew, okay, what is the justice for Christina Carlson, his first wife who died in that fire? And sure enough, I waited, as did everyone else who was the family of Christina. And sure enough, in 2020, Carl Carlson faced a murder trial in January and February, right before COVID shut the world down. And I went out to California and covered that trial. And thank goodness, a fire investigator had saved the evidence because he felt that it would be needed at some point down the road. Now, this is 30 years
wow.
later.
That's amazing.
Amazing. Amazing. And the evidence included audio tapes, interviews, a video of the crime scene. You know, you could see where the window had been boarded up with 17 nails. There were experts who had gone through the scene at the time. All of those records had been saved by a fire investigator. And, you know, what's interesting about that is when somebody retires, typically they're not allowed to take boxes of evidence. And that was actually, you know, not kosher. But this fire expert really truly believed that justice would happen for Christina Carlson. So when he retired, he knew one thing, which is after 7 years, the department destroys and throws out records. And he knew that. And so it had been that long. So he took out of his locker, out of the evidence locker, those boxes of evidence and brought them home and locked them in his own locker in his basement and kept them there. So the chain of custody wasn't broken because all the evidence was sealed. And from the initial time when they did the investigation on this and couldn't pin the murder on Carlson. And so that's where he didn't realize that, oh, he thought he got away with that. And they had ruled it accidental and they had paid out $200,000 of insurance money on the murder or death of Christina Carlson. And later it came back, oh, no, no, he's convicted of murder. And also came in the murder of his son, because under modus operandi, both victims were killed for insurance money. However, there's a bigger story about Levi and his father and the convoluted relationship they had for all those years until he turned 23, and bizarre happenings that I don't want to give away that are in the book that have never been talked about on any of the TV shows that have covered this case, and how twisted Carl Carlson's mind is. And I, you know, in that case, I was able to speak with Carl Carlson for almost 2 years, 5 days a week. We had a standing appointment. He would call me from jail. And he hadn't been sent back to prison yet. He's talking to me before his trial, during his trial, and after his trial, which is unheard of. First of all, no defendant who's facing murder charges and a trial, which would be allowed to talk or would decide to talk to anybody in the media. And then during the trial, he's talking to me. It was very strange. He's a nut, mm-hmm. to put it simply.
That's
a wild. Real nut, a real nut. And so in the book, you see comments from him straight out of his mouth that you really can't believe this is real. Honestly, I've had people say to me, I read the book, I couldn't put it down, but I had to keep looking back at the pictures because I couldn't believe this was real. And there is that sensibility in this book, which is why, you know, it is selling so much. And I'm happy about it because I spent 4 years on that. And that's a lot of time.
To ask you how long you spend writing books. This one was 4 years.
4 years. Yeah, it was about three times longer than any of my other books. Okay. Typically, within a year, I can produce the book.
Okay.
Not this one, because it was mountains of documentation to go through, mountains of videos, audios, transcripts, police reports from two coasts, right? And then all the interviews that I conducted. And I was fortunate enough to have access to Cindy Carlson, who, imagine, she lived in the house with this killer. And eventually she figured out he's a killer and hired a PI. And the PI says, you got to stay there because there's no other evidence. Now she's sleeping with a murderer. Jesus. With a knife and a scissors under her bed and nunchucks. I think about this, you know, I think often about the Rex Heuermann serial killer, the Gilgo Beach serial killer. And people ask me, would you write that book? Well, the only way I could do that is if I could get to his wife, because she lived with him, right? And at some point she had to know something, or she didn't know anything, but that lifestyle they must have had in there had to be super weird. And I don't think I'll ever get to that wife, because they suspect that she participated in some of this or was aware. I'm not sure that she did or was. I don't believe that, but I think she would probably feel you know, that the finger would start to get pointed at her if she cooperated or did work with anybody else. But my point being, if you could get inside that household with somebody who's living with a killer, you know, then you have access to what a bizarre life that had to have been. And that's what happens with Levi's Eyes.
Yes. And what a perfect title for it, too. Who comes up with the title for the books? Do you do that, or does the publisher chime in?
I do.
Love it.
Yeah. No, Levi's Eyes, you have to remember what it goes back to, and the twisted notion here is what he saw.
Right.
What he knew.
Mm-hmm.
That he had seen. And it was a threat to his father. So the father didn't kill him just for life insurance money. That was extra. Mm-hmm. There was something else going on there in their twisted.
How many years was it between his mother's death and then or murder and then the time that he was killed?
So she was killed on New Year's Day, 1991, and he was killed on November 20th, 2008.
Wow.
Wow. So quite a few years later, and then justice didn't happen for Christina until 2020. So in essence, that was 30 years later.
Dang. Unbelievable story. Everybody go pick up the book. And the writing style too, like I said before, is so good. It just draws you in. You feel like it's, I told Renee, I said, it's just like the way you and I talk to each other. Yeah. It's not, you're not getting caught up in trying to interpret what they're saying. Exactly. You're just talking to us. I just love that.
Thank you.
So have you ever changed your mind about a case after you wrote about it or did a TV show about it? Have you looked back on it and gone, well, wait, new stuff's come out. I feel differently about that.
So in the case of the Michael Jackson criminal trial in Santa Maria, which I covered gavel to gavel for Fox News.
Yes.
Before Fox News became so one-sided, you know, back when things were a little different.
Right.
Any event, during that trial, and prior to going there, I had already determined that Michael Jackson was guilty. And so did the rest of the media. So we were all looking for a guilty verdict, and we believed it was going to happen. People were saying he really should flee the country. He's going to be locked up. People were waiting. There were people lined up to who would get the first photograph of him in jail. Right. And, you know, that would have been a cottage industry of people. Think about it. If Jackson is in jail and he's sick and he doesn't have a wig on or blah, blah, whatever the case may be. And then who visited him? Was it Janet Jackson? Was it Debbie Rowe? Was it his? All of that would be a constant fodder for the tabloids. And it would have been a huge million-dollar industry just on Michael Jackson. And I believed he was guilty. I truly did. Sat through the whole trial, watched everything. And then when it was over at the end, when the jury came down with, you know, all those not guilty verdicts, I really, all of a sudden, I realized the emperor has no clothes. Wait a minute here. What's going on? Oh, I get it. There was never any real evidence that he did anything to this kid, because the truth of the matter was, and what was testified to in court, is that this kid had cancer. And Martin Bashir, the documentarian, brought that kid to Neverland in order to film a part of the documentary about how Michael Jackson helps children who are sick. And that documentarian also insisted that they get on the bed together and hold hands and then ask the question, do you sleep together in the bed? And Michael said, sure, it's not sexual, la la. And then, of course, that went viral. That went crazy when it aired in England. Martin Bashir made a big name for himself at the time. He set Michael Jackson up totally. And the truth of the matter was, and we saw this in court, is that that boy went back to Neverland along with his mother and his siblings after the Bashir documentary aired. And they taped what they call a rebuttal video, which no one has really seen. And in that rebuttal video, the family, the mother and the three kids, including the accuser, talk about how good Michael was to them, how they called him Daddy Michael, how he saved the kid from cancer. The kids themselves says, Michael told me to eat the cancer cells up like Pac-Man, just eat them up, you can. And so they're talking about no one cared about us other than Michael. Where were they, the mother was saying, when we didn't have food to put on the table, where were they? Well, we saw that over and over again in court, but yet no one reported on it because in my case, the producers for Fox News, Bill O'Reilly, wouldn't let me answer any questions or talk about things I wanted to talk about, exculpatory evidence, which that was, even though I kind of believed at the time maybe they were coached. They later testified they were coached to participate in that rebuttal video. So you had two sides of the coin there you could choose to believe. I still wanted to present that to the audiences and say, you know.
And Bill O'Reilly and his people said no. Yeah, that's
right. Incredible. Jesse Waters was the booker at that time. You know, we're going back almost 20 years. So now he's got his own show. He's replaced Bill O'Reilly. So he was the booker, young kid. And he would tell, you know, they would tell me what it is they want me to talk about that day. And that's how news works, you know. And we can see it now because it's so one-sided. In that case, back in time, almost 20 years ago, 19, when I wrote that book and when I covered that case and I had my aha moment where I realized the jury got it right. This kid had cancer. If Michael Jackson was going after any kid, this would be the last kid on earth he'd go after. And not only that, but, you know, this quote unquote molestation happened supposedly after the Bashir documentary aired, not before. So the timing is all screwed up. So wait a minute, let's rewind, rewind. And I went back to Santa Maria. I requested that I get a judgment, an order from the judge in order to look at the evidence, which he then gave to the public. Nobody else bothered to look at that evidence. So I'm the only one who has it because it was destroyed because there was an acquittal. And you know, in that evidence, as I'm watching the police interview with Gavin Arvizo, you realize you don't believe it. You're not sure, like, why are they coaching him, the police? And then there are many other things that were in the evidence that the kid says he doesn't know what ejaculation is. And I'm thinking, okay, he's 13 years old. You know what that is. Like, no. So I changed my mind and decided I'm going to expose the media. Are you there?
That's a great idea. That's awesome. Yes, we're here. Did you lose us?
Yeah, no, I'm here. My iPhone's going haywire.
Oh, we can hear you.
Yeah, we can hear you. You're doing great.
Good. The meeting being recorded. Okay, sorry about that. Anyway, so where was I? Change my mind.
Michael Jackson. You were saying that
13-year-old boy
knows what that is. That was kind of the last thing you said.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Right.
Cool.
So you know, at the end of the day, I realized that Jackson was innocent and the jury got it right. And I went back through the evidence and I went back through all the trial transcripts and was able to produce a book called Michael Jackson Conspiracy,
yes,
where in essence, the prosecutor, Tom Steddon, was conspiring against Jackson all along after the Jordy Chandler settlement. And so for many years, he did whatever he could going around the world to Australia and wherever else to try to find victims so that he could get Jackson behind bars. And that did not work out for him. And I felt at the time that I was destroying my career as a media journalist because I was actually outing all the rest of the journalists who had covered this trial. And it was 2,400 journalists. 2,400 credentialed journalists were outside that courtroom. Only 50 of us got inside the courtroom. And nobody corrected anything after Jackson was found not guilty. Nobody made any kind of attempt to rationalize or understand why the jury came up with not guilty verdicts. And by that time, when I wrote that book, I thought, well, I'm going to have to move to Costa Rica when this is all over because I won't have any career anymore. Really? That's what I thought.
I can imagine that feeling.
Yeah. That's great. It was something. And, now,
big name.
Back then, there was no social media. Remember, we're in 2005. Mm. So it wasn't really a thing. And there were no cross checks on this. The fans were there in person. Many of the fans had come from all over the world in waves. And they had a sense of what was going on because they're outside the courtroom. But no, nobody did anything about it. And nobody really told the truth. And I thought, you know what? I owe it to the public to tell the truth here.
Right.
And if I have to sacrifice my career, then so be it. And as it turned out, now we know how slanted the news is, right?
Mm-hmm.
What
are your thoughts on, it's been a few years since I've seen it, so I'm fuzzy on the details, but what are your thoughts on that documentary called Leaving Neverland? Is that what it was called?
Yeah, that's what it's called.
What do you think about that?
It was very compelling. I'm not going to deny that. However, Wade Robson was the very first witness to testify for the defense. The first witness, number one.
Yeah.
Why would he do that? Why would he get up on the stand to say that Michael was such a mentor to him and Michael was, you know, just made his life and that he loved Michael and Mike. And I have notes from evidence from the Robson family saying, you know, be strong, Michael. Well, so they're supporting Michael Jackson in every way. And Wade Robson decides to be the first witness for the defense. And yet now he's claiming a whole new story.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And yeah.
A lot of money
involved. I don't
remember
the details of that show, but I do remember those boys as men saying it happened. So it's just crazy, you know, on what to believe. But yeah, I do remember that when Michael Jackson's trial was going on and you're right. That would have been amazing. If he went to prison, you're right. I never thought of it that way. That would have been a huge circus and like you said, a multimillion-dollar industry of getting
absolutely.
Pictures.
based on just Michael Jackson.
Yeah, yeah. Unbelievable.
And the drama.
Yes.
Is he suicidal? Is he not suicidal? You could just picture, you know.
Oh, yeah. Every move would be documented. Is he, you know, being held by himself? Does he get to get out of his cell? All that stuff.
Everything. Yeah, imagine everything. Yeah. That's, you know, he's sick. He's not sick. He's this. He's trying to get drugs. He's whatever it is, they would make it up.
Yeah, that would have been outrageously huge.
Mm-hmm. And they were anticipating that. So, you know, the media was very disappointed. People were shocked when the verdicts came out. You could see mouths, jaws dropping open on some of them. And, you know, again, going after the media, which I did back then, I mean, I was scary to me. Going after the media now, however, is something that everybody seems to be doing on social media, and they all go against each other as well. You know, you see, you watch CNN, they're going after Fox. You watch Fox, they're going after CNN and MSNBC. It's like, and MSNBC plays that same game. So we don't really know what the truth is anymore, right. I feel.
Yeah, right? You were one of the first to do that, that's for sure. Because back then, you're right, we weren't all, the media wasn't all attacking each other like they do now.
Right.
Pretty wild.
And so it's like people believed the media like it was gospel back then. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't.
No.
It wasn't.
Yeah. No, I hear what you're saying. I remember just growing up, my parents watching the news and being like, well, that's what happened, you know? You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And but back in time also, I have to say that, you know, way back in time, that, you know, it was straight reportage. You know, there's a war, people, this many got killed, whatever, the fire happened, whatever the news may be. And whatever it was, they reported slowly and surely, but surely, and certainly with Michael Jackson, the media had a way of slanting everything for his whole life to make him look like a freak, mm-hmm. You know. And for example, the moment where he held Blanket, the baby, over the banister, balcony in Germany, right? Well, he talks about that in the documentary. We saw the full documentary footage Martin Bashir did, and we saw it in trial. And he says, you know, I held Blanket out because the fans were down there begging me to show them my new baby. And they were begging and they were going and they weren't leaving. And I sent pizzas down to the fans and da da da. And finally, I decided I would hold Blanket out so they could just see him for a few seconds. And he says, I held that baby so tight. And he loved his children. I mean, that's so clear. And so he says, they ran it over and over and over again on the news and talked about how I was basically going to throw my baby. And Gloria Allred said that he should have the baby taken away because it's child abuse and all the rest. No, it wasn't. But the media could make it look that way.
Absolutely. And I'm afraid the media has done that in other cases too. And that's a whole different episode, but you know, of people being convicted that shouldn't have been maybe convicted, you know, the media can gang up and work with prosecutors and, you know, that's all, like I said, that's another whole podcast. I've got a case in mind, but you know, with, you know, young people today don't realize how big Michael Jackson really, really was. I mean, he would gather, like you said, you know, he would go to his balcony at a hotel. So many people would gather that it looks like you're looking at a picture of a music festival, but he's not right. Performing music. That's not a concert. He was just waving at fans. That's how big he was. He was absolutely humongous back then. And it's hard to even conceptualize of that.
There's nobody who can compare to him in terms of the fame. He was known worldwide. This was when no internet. This was when nothing, okay, was worldwide. Nothing.
Yeah.
But he was worldwide. And he has fans to this day that are avid in Germany, in Japan, in various other countries in Europe. I mean, I constantly get, you know, people come from Korea, from Belgium. I mean, this is regular. It happens to me all the time that people want to hear more about it because they didn't get the full story or they don't have the book. It wasn't translated into whatever language. And, you know, although it has been translated into a lot of languages, I will say that, which is cool. Michael Jackson, without doubt, is the biggest single star that we can think of in history. I don't think there is anybody else who reached the Aborigines in Australia, you know? I just don't.
No, absolutely. Okay, so what's next? for you, Aphrodite. We hear you're pitching a show, or you're going to start pitching shows.
Pitching a show. I'm also contemplating starting a YouTube channel rather than a podcast. Nice. I have so many true crime stories that, for example, what I did on my show, I did 63 episodes, and of those, especially the books I wrote, those stories have not been explored in the way that they should be or told. And I really do want to have sort of more interactivity with the audience. So I have to kind of figure that out. I don't know how possible that is, because I know it's difficult to do that and be live, but I'm trying to suss that out. In the meantime, right now, I am just taking a break, ladies, from...
I was going to ask you. That sounds like you probably need one. You've done a lot, and just spent 4 years on this book that just recently came out. I think I would take a breather, too. Yeah. That sounds like a good idea.
I need to do that. I truly need to do that. I have to kind of juice up again. And, you know, that's one of the things in this genre. You will find the longer you're in it, you do need to break away from it. You know, because you can just get so depressed and feel like the world is just twisted.
Yeah.
And then you have to remind yourself, no, these are individual instances. This is not normal that somebody gets murdered. The news makes it seem like it's normal because it's every other day there's a new murder. But that's not reality for all of us, right?
That's
right.
The way it was for me with Shanann Watts, with Chris Watts that killed her and the whole family. I was so into that case. And then eventually I had to pull myself away from it, because it was getting to the point where every time I saw an oil well, I would think of them. And then every time I would see a video of her, it would literally make me cry to where it would like stress me out. I was like, okay, I'm done. So I had to pull back from that one. That one really got me.
And the thing I notice about with my life is, no matter where I go, I'm in California. I mean, that's the Berkeley Marina. That was the whole Scott Peterson thing. Oh, I mean, I can't not look at the San Francisco Bridge and the Golden Gate Bridge and not think about how he hoped that her and her child would be swept out under that bridge. And, you know, or anything else. It's interesting to me, and kind of horrifying, that I'll see like a particular restaurant or a gas station or whatever that's a chain, like Circle K. The book I wrote, Cruel Sacrifice, about those girls, is the most haunting of all the books I've ever written. And so they battered and abused and violated her with a tire iron. It's a horrifying story of a 12-year-old who was murdered. But the thing about it was, she wasn't dead. So they actually poured gasoline on her and lit her on fire. And she was still breathing. And that's how she died. Horrifying. And it was, they went to a Circle K, which is a big chain.
Right.
And a gas station kind of thing, convenience store. And they went in and they bought a big 2-liter or liter, whatever it is, bottle of Coke, poured it out outside the gas station, and filled it up with gas. So anytime I see a Circle K, if I'm traveling, I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah. Right. Because you think,
you know, I was just in Naples, Florida. I saw it as a, you know, I wish they didn't have it down here, because now it makes me. So that's the kind of thing that I have to fight. You know, it's very difficult to unsee things. For example, Shanda Scherer, who is a 12-year-old, when I was doing that, and of course, I get into the evidence. I go to the courtroom. I go to the DA. I get the evidence in my hands on every one of these cases. So now I'm at the DA's office, and they're going to let me see this video, and it's of Shanda in the field where she was killed. And the clerk says to me, are you sure you want to watch it by yourself? Would you like me to sit here with you? I said, no, it's fine. You know, I wanted to write my notes and whatever. Little did I know that to see what happened to that child, and to see how her skin was all charcoal, and to think she looked like a blow up doll from the distance, and then they get closer and closer. I can't ever unsee that.
No.
And similarly with what happened to Shanda Scherer, they had locked her in the trunk of a car. And she, in those old days, old cars, you could get through the back, through the speakers. You could get into the back seat. There was a possibility of that, not anymore. And that child was in that car. being violated and hit with a tire iron and again raped, etc. And I say etc. because I don't want to get into details. And I got the police to let me see that car and open the trunk, and the blood, I could still smell it. It was dry, but it was brown, but it was there, and it was all throughout the trunk. And you could see where she was trying to scratch her way through the speaker area where the speakers were. And again, that's something I can never, ever forget or unsee.
No.
And so, you know, unlike people who are doing podcasts, unlike people who are doing stories for television, you know, they don't get that involved. They don't have the opportunity or the time really to do that kind of work. Mm-hmm. And even in my show, I would insist on, I want court transcripts. I want, you know, I did the West Memphis 3. I'm in the police station getting the actual documents that to me are showing these kids were set up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as I'm doing all of that, people are thinking in the television world, you know, we don't have time for all this. We don't have time for all this. And I'm thinking, no, we do have time for this because I need to look at this stuff. So again, that kind of faded away over time because, you know, producers and television networks have their own idea of how much in depth you should go. And I want to get back to that. So that's really in the plan, whether I do it on my YouTube channel, whether I do it on there and then transfer to TV, both, whatever. And then there's also the Michael Jackson documentary that I'm working on, which we'll see if we can get that made. A documentary that's going to be an answer to Leaving Neverland, a documentary that's going to show people don't know why Jackson was acquitted. They think it was star power. No, it was not. There's a lot of evidence in that trial that nobody has seen, the rebuttal video, the full tape of the Bashir interview. The thing is, we need to get to the Jackson estate in order to do that because the Jackson estate owns those videos. And even though I have copies of them and they were entered in court, I don't want the Jackson estate coming after me. So there's a whole dance that has to happen in order to look at getting that documentary done. But there's a lot of interest in it and financiers for it because they know that people around the world would watch it. So that's a project I'm in the midst of. I'm also going to be speaking at CrimeCon this year, which I did 7 years ago. I was the inaugural speaker on that whole thing, which is now a huge deal. I'm going to do a presentation on Michael Peterson and the book I wrote, The Perfect Husband, and how The Staircase is a total lie. I'm going to expose it. And the best is that I'm bringing along Amy Beth Berner, who is an eyewitness to what she saw in Germany at the stairwell where her friend Elizabeth Ratliff was found by Michael Peterson at the bottom of the stairs. And so, you know, it's going to be quite shocking when people realize why there is an owl theory, because I know why, and also what the real evidence is that was conveniently left out of the documentary, The Staircase, 13 hours, never mentioned, luminol, blood tracks, you know, all the various evidence that was just ignored. There was blood on a Coke can outside in the back of the mansion. There was a blood drop in the front that they found. There was blood on the wall frame. There's an indication that she had been dead for hours. I don't want to get into all of it here, but I will get into all of it at CrimeCon. So I've got that awesome. Coming up.
Yeah.
Busy.
Can't wait. Okay. Well, awesome. We're so excited you're on True Crime Rods. Thank you so much. You know, there's a case that we kind of got, what got our podcast started was the Missy Beavers case. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it. It's super bizarre. Poor
I
Missy.
Do. I know it, of course.
Yeah. She's our age, you know, mine and Renee's age. Renee actually knew her, my co-host here. I didn't know her personally, but I was attracted to the case because her three kids are the same age as my three kids. And I grew up in that area as well. And she walks in to teach her Camp Gladiator class to get set up before students arrive. And she's killed by someone in police tactical gear. Do you have any thoughts on that case? Have you dug into it at all? Or what are your initial, your initial reaction to that video?
So my initial thing is, first of all, I'm so glad that you, and I know Renee, you worked with her at some point, that that you decided to do this case and that, you know, that was what launched you into your podcast. Both of you are very brave and really just, it's important that people do not forget those cases that have never been solved. And oftentimes what happens is if something's unsolved, it's a story on TV for a minute, and then that's the end of it. So I'm glad that you've kept it alive. And I give you kudos for that. it's interesting that the person, it's very eerie to see that footage of the perpetrator, the murderer, walking around very casually in the hallway of the church. And to think about what time that was, we're talking about 4 o'clock, 4:30 in the morning, before 5 o'clock in the morning. How did this person know exactly when she would have, Missy would have been coming in there to teach her class? How did this person know that the class would be taught inside? Because usually this class was taught outside, and only if it's raining did she go inside. So there are a lot of little elements here. Who was this person? Was it a male? Was it a female? There are a lot of theories about this. I personally think, looking at it, you know, the person looks like they're doing some kind of weird moonwalk, and not Michael Jackson moonwalk either. It's some kind of, right? It's some kind of like force of gravity that's not working right. And you wonder, right, is this person wearing bigger shoes? Because that's what I think.
That's what we think.
Right? And so that would make me think it's a female. Somebody pointed out at some point that the person never adjusted their crotch, which is something a man would do.
Oh,
that didn't happen.
That is a good point.
Right? Yeah. So, you know, I have dug into this case. I don't know why they haven't been able to pin this on perhaps the wife of the person that Missy was having an affair with. I can't understand that. You know, is there evidence they're holding back? Well, yeah, we know that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you got to play the long game. Remember, as I said with Christina Carlson, that didn't happen for 30 years.
Right.
You know, they played the long game. That fire investigator counted on that. That's why he took that evidence. Okay. So they got to play close to the vest. People really don't understand that either, you know, especially the victim's family. They're like, why aren't you telling us what you've got? Why aren't you telling? Well, and true crime fanatics out there, you know, why don't we know? Well, because if you knew, you're going to give away to the suspect what you've got. And I remember another case I covered. I had done a television show long ago for Buena Vista called The Justice Hunters. And I had a team of people with me that we were looking at unsolved cases. And one of them was a woman who was killed by someone who came to the door dressed as a clown. And we knew who it was, but we couldn't say that on the air because it would be considered, you know, slander, libel. And, but we knew who it was. And so as time went on, it took many years, but one day, it was a Florida case. I was in Florida, and there it was on the front page of the newspaper. That person got caught, and it took, I don't know, 20 years.
Wow.
They what finally was pinned it on that woman.
How did they do it? Do you know?
DNA, hair.
Nice.
She had a wig on as well. There were a lot of different, there was a witness who finally came forward who knew about the woman's whereabouts and her strange dealings prior. So, you know, and that's something that will also happen is that, you know, DNA was not around and back in time. So then they were able to have new, you know, evidence. And also the witnesses sometimes are afraid to come forward. And then later, as time moves on, they realize, you know what, I need to talk about this because it's on their mind. It's on their conscience, you know. So, awesome. I think it's great that you're doing this case. I think there will be a closure to this.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure. Possibly there are two people involved. I don't know what you all think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Your instincts are great. Yeah. I'm so glad to hear that you think
right
it'll be fine.
With you.
Yeah.
I think somebody was diverting. I think the person in the hallway was a diversion.
I think the person in the hallway was way too comfortable.
Sorry.
That makes sense.
You're the second guest who's mentioned that. That's interesting. Yeah. You're right though. The person does look really comfortable. We've heard
too comfortable. And you know, I don't care who you are and how comfortable you are in a setting. If you're about to commit murder, you're not swinging the hammer around.
Yeah.
And you're not letting yourself be looked at on camera either.
Yeah, crazy.
This person wanted to create a diversion. My theory, okay?
Yeah.
You know, anyone else can say, no, we don't know. And we don't know. Somebody would need to divert attention away, especially so that the police would get this footage you know, the closed circuit footage, the surveillance footage, and see, oh, who are we looking for? We don't know who we're looking for. Here's the perp. Maybe not.
You know, the woman that we've gotten some intel on that has been looked at by police, of course, we don't know who killed Missy Beavers, but that person was known to stay up all night doing crystal meth. So is it possible that person just looks, you know, like that because they habitually just stay up and on, you know, because I'm just saying that I'm the same age as all these people and I would have gotten tired by four. I wouldn't have been able to. I wouldn't have been able to take on this big project of trying to kill someone and not rain. And run out and not get caught
in the tactical gear
in the pouring down right. rain. Yeah, I would have been like, no, y'all, that's fine. I'm tired. And
right.
Oh, you know, you just never. Let's.
You know, when it comes to murder, there are no simple answers.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true.
It'll be interesting to see how this unfolds. It'll be 8 years next month is the 8-year anniversary of Missy Beavers' murder. And that's just too long for us, but I hear what you're saying. Some of them are long game and we're just going to have to.
It's been so many twists and turns. And it feels like a lifetime movie. That's been a lifetime. Literally.
I hear you. I know how that feels. And again, when I was waiting for that other shoe to drop on Christina Carlson, that didn't happen until 2020. So think about that. I covered the case in 2014. And the family who believed that she had been killed back in New Year's Day, 1991. So in essence, 1990, 30 years prior, waited for 30 years for justice.
Unbelievable. Girl, that's horrible.
It really is horrible.
It is horrible. I mean, we're over here in about 8 years and
we're big time whining about the 8 years. That's way too long in our book.
That's just too much.
Yes.
It's not funny, but it does make me laugh because I get it.
Yes.
Well, it's aggravating. You're like, wait a minute. What do the police have? There has to be something. Why aren't they going after this? Why aren't you think they're not doing anything? And they may not be doing anything besides waiting.
And Midlothian's a really small town. It's not like they have murders all the time. You know, this isn't Philadelphia. You know, this isn't even Dallas. This is Midlothian. So, yeah, it's just been crazy. But we're so excited to have you on the show. We hope to have you on again sometime. Thank you for just spending some time with us. And everybody go out there and get Levi's Eyes. Great book.
Yes,
it's on Amazon.
Great.
Yeah, we'll link it in our show notes. And please keep in touch. Please let us know if there's anything we can do or anything you've got coming up. Yeah, we don't want to miss anything. So we're going to be watching.
Okay. Are you guys going to be at CrimeCon?
Yes, we're planning on it. Yes.
Okay. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing you there.
We can't wait to meet you in person. Okay.
Me too.
Have a great day. Thanks again.
Thank you, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.